The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy, King Features. Onion juice eases the pain of wasp sting. Question. I read about using a sliced onion on a bee sting or wasp sting. I tried this trick after a wasp got me on my little finger. I cut an onion and put it on the sting spot. It felt a little better, but I wanted fast relief. I chopped the onion into small pieces and put some in my garlic press. I squeezed the juice into a small bowl, soaked a gauze pad with it, and applied it to my finger. Right away, the pain was gone and the swelling was much reduced. Answer. More than 30 years ago, a reader shared this story about treating a yellow jacket sting. Quote, a friend told me to cut an onion and press the cut side to the sting, holding it there for 10 minutes. I tried it the last time I got stung, and miracle of miracles, it really worked. I thought your other readers would like to know about this, unquote. Since then, we have heard from many other people that a fresh cut onion can ease the pain of a sting. Anyone who is allergic to sting should use an epinephrine auto-injector or seek emergency medical attention. Question. About 4 years ago, one of my doctors told me that I would be on acid-blocking drugs for the rest of my life. I'd had trouble with acid reflux for about 10 years by that time. This expert couldn't tell me what causes acid reflux, just that the medicine would control it. At that point, I started checking into the causes of my problem. After doing my own research, I figured out how to change my eating habits and get control of the reflux. I was able to quit taking the drug. After I had been on it for 3 months, I've had good success over the past few years with my revised diet. Now that I am fasting regularly, acid reflux is seldom an annoyance. Answer, thank you for sharing your success story. Taiwanese doctors conducted a small crossover study in patients with gastroesophageal reflux disease and found that high carbohydrate diets make the reflux worse. That's cited in Journal of the Formosan Medical Association, November 2018. This connection was first reported in 2006 in Digestive Diseases and Sciences, August 2006, but not all gastroenterologists are aware of the link. Cutting back on sugar might also be helpful, cited in European Surgery, December 2017. We appreciate your observation on intermittent fasting. Researchers don't appear to have studied this very much, but perhaps others will want to try it for their reflux symptoms. Migraine preventive medicine working. Question. About a year ago, I learned about a new migraine medicine called Aimovig, and it's spelled A-I-M-O-V-I-G. I asked my neurologist if he could prescribe it. Since I was averaging 9 major headaches and 18 days off work each month, this drug changed my life. I inject it every 28 days and I average just 1 headache a month. Answer. Other readers also have reported substantial improvement with Arenamob or Aimovig. The Food and Drug Administration has also approved 2 other injectable drugs in this class, Furmanzimab, which is Ajovy, and Galcanzimab, which is Emgality, E-M-G-A-L-I-T-Y. They are for migraine prevention rather than treatment. The auto-injectors can cost over $500 unless insurance covers them, as it frequently does. Side effects of Aimovig can include constipation, nausea, hair loss, muscle aches, and joint pain. Question. Drug ads on TV aimed at consumers are misleading. I was diagnosed with highly aggressive rheumatoid arthritis. The ads for meds to help RA sufferers show unhappy, miserable people unable to do, quote, fun, unquote, things. Then after they take the advertised med, suddenly, happy people are running around doing all kinds of things. Take my word for it. True, rheumatoid arthritis victims could not engage in these activities with such energy. I consider this false advertising. Answer. We agree that most prescription drug commercials emphasize the benefits and downplay the risks. The visual images of people having fun distract viewers from the list of often serious side effects such as fatal infections, lymphoma, and heart failure. We wish the FDA were stricter in its oversight of these ads. Question. As a dentist, I see angular chelitis very often. This is a common problem for elderly people with old, worn-out dentures. The denture's teeth are so worn that the bite is closed, and this creates an excessive wrinkle in the corners of the mouth. Generally, there is also a chronic fungal infection under the dentures as well. We dentists prescribe an ointment with a mixture of an antifungal and a steroid. You can get the same effect without a prescription by mixing Monistat with hydrocortisone. The ointment form works best. Answer, thank you for the advice on angular chelitis, a condition in which one or both corners of the mouth become red, sore, and even cracked. I'm going to continue last week's section from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter on diagnosing heart trouble. We're talking about first steps. Stress test with imaging. This type of test is commonly used when pharmacologic stress testing is performed when a resting ECG can't provide diagnostic clues or when a person has known coronary artery disease. An exercise stress test may be combined with imaging of the heart using ultrasound echocardiography. Additional imaging options include single photon emission computerized tomography, which is SPECT, S-P-E-C-T, or cardiac position emission tomography, which is a PET, P-E-T. Both PET, SPECT, and PET are considered nuclear scans because a small amount of radioactive substance, which is a tracer, is injected through an intravenous IV line. After the tracer is taken up by the heart muscle, images of heart blood supply and function can be obtained while at rest and after you've exercised or taken a drug to mimic stress on the heart. Magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, is a pharmacologic stress imaging option that involves a gadolinium-based dye rather than a radioactive tracer. Thyroid nodules, when to act and when to relax. It's always been part of your routine physical exam. Your doctor feels your throat area quickly, then moves on, but this time there's a pause. Your doctor feels a lump in your thyroid gland, located just under the skin by your swallowing tube or the esophagus, and asks if you've had any difficulty swallowing. Lumps in the thyroid, called thyroid nodules, are common. The likelihood of having one is higher in women and increases with age. It's estimated up to 50% of adults older than 50 may have one. Thankfully, around 90 to 95% of thyroid nodules are non-cancerous or benign. Still, follow-up to determine whether they're benign or cancerous is important. When cancer is caught early and confined to the thyroid gland, treatment is usually very successful. Making the find. A thyroid nodule is often discovered by feel or during an imaging scan of the neck area, done for another reason, or it's an incidental finding. Occasionally, a nodule may first be noticed if it causes swelling in the neck or if it's large enough to make swallowing uncomfortable or difficult. In rare cases, nodules can cause changes in thyroid hormone levels, which is hyperthyroidism. This can cause unexplained weight loss, nervousness, or heart rhythm issues. An initial exam of a thyroid nodule can help point the way for additional testing, and this may include a physical exam and discussion of factors that may increase the risk of finding cancer, such as previous head or neck radiation, or family history of thyroid cancer, or discussing other thyroid-related issues you have, a blood test to measure thyroid hormone levels, and ultrasound imaging, which can identify the size and number of nodules and reveal characteristics that can help raise or lower suspicion that a nodule is cancerous. Sorting it out, fine needle aspiration, FNA, biopsy is another diagnostic step that may be performed when results of the initial exam and ultrasound raise the suspicion of cancer. It's an office-based procedure done with a local anesthesia and ultrasound guidance. A sample of the nodule cells is removed for examination to determine if the tissue is cancerous or benign, although sometimes the results are uncertain. Not every nodule requires a biopsy. Results of an initial exam and ultrasound can reveal nodule characteristics, such as the size and appearance, that greatly reduce the odds of cancer. In these cases, fine needle aspiration biopsy may not be performed, but the nodule is often monitored over time. For nodules that occur in conjunction with hyperthyroidism, a thyroid scan, which is a scintigraphy, which is scintigraphy, may be performed. This can indicate if the nodule itself is producing extra thyroid hormones. If so, the nodule is virtually certain to be benign, and biopsy isn't needed. Nodules not producing extra thyroid hormones typically require biopsy. FNA biopsy results aren't always definitive. When they're not, newer molecular tests that look for genetic signs of cancer in the biopsy sample may be used. These aren't definitive either, but they can help provide a better picture of cancer risk. Treatment direction. Treatment options vary depending on the type of nodule and may include watchful waiting for non-cancerous nodules. The great majority of thyroid nodules are harmless. However, monitoring them periodically is often done to keep an eye out for suspicious changes such as rapid growth or change in appearance. Reduction in size of a large benign nodule. Sometimes a nodule can get large enough to cause signs or symptoms such as difficulty swallowing. These larger nodules can be removed with neck surgery. In addition, newer procedure involves inserting a thin probe into the nodule, then heating the tip using radio frequency energy. This destroys the nodule tissue, potentially reducing the size by about half. Removal of cancerous nodules or nodules that are highly suspected to be cancerous. This involves surgery to remove most or all of the thyroid gland and sometimes nearby lymph nodes. If cancer has advanced beyond the thyroid, treatment with radioactive iodine may be used to destroy leftover cancer cells. In select cases, small cancerous nodules can be destroyed with ethanol injection. Addressing nodules that cause hyperthyroidism. Options include surgically removing the nodule, destroying it with radioactive iodine, or taking a medication to normalize thyroid hormone levels. Finally, watchful waiting with select cancerous nodules. The most common type of cancerous thyroid nodule grows so slowly that it's unlikely to cause any problems. Some people, particularly those with very small cancers or who are poor candidates for surgery, may elect to hold off on surgical removal with periodic ultrasound monitoring to watch for concerning changes. Second opinion. Question. I've heard that genetic testing can help determine which antidepressant would be best for me. How does this work? Answer. Genetic testing is available to help narrow down your antidepressant options, ideally reducing the need for a sometimes prolonged trial and error period while setting on an antidepressant regimen. Although these tests can't tell you specifically which antidepressant would work best, they offer clues about how your body may respond. This testing, known as pharmacogenomics, looks for changes or variations in genes that determine how quickly a drug is processed or metabolized in your body, or whether you might have side effects from a certain drug. Pharmacogenomic tests check your DNA obtained by blood drawn or a swab for saliva for genes that encode certain enzymes, and the results can be classified according to how fast your body metabolizes and gets rid of certain medications, such as particular antidepressants. For example, if testing indicates that your body metabolizes a drug too slowly, the drug might build up in your body and increase the likelihood of side effects. While the drug may still be useful for you, lower doses may be appropriate. On the other hand, if testing suggests that the drug would leave your body quickly, it may not have a chance to work properly, or it would require a larger than normal dose. However, genetic testing has limits. Most of these tests focus on how your body metabolizes a drug rather than on how the drug influences the cause of disease, although some tests address that issue as well. Cost is also an issue, as not all insurance companies cover this type of testing. Choosing antidepressants based on your health history and symptoms is still standard. Routine genetic testing isn't recommended at this time. Still, the testing may offer important clues to aid in drug selection and dosing, especially for people having trouble finding an effective option with few side effects. Question: I was having an abdominal CT scan for another reason, and a mass was found on the adrenal gland on top of one of my kidneys. My doctors say it's unlikely to be cancer, but recommend keeping an eye on it. Shouldn't a biopsy be done? Answer: fortunately, if a mass is found in one or both of the hormone-releasing adrenal glands, it is usually not cancer and causes no other problems. However, an evaluation of the mass is typically necessary. Adrenal masses are estimated to occur in 3-7% of older adults, but 95% of the time they're not cancerous. However, a small number of these non-cancerous adrenal masses can increase hormone levels and cause health problems such as high blood pressure, low potassium, diabetes, and even increased risk of heart disease. Distinguishing a potentially harmful mass from a harmless one can often be done with imaging, most commonly a CT scan, targeted at assessing the mass. A cancerous mass will likely be larger with an irregular shape. A non-cancerous mass will likely have a smoother, rounder shape and be smaller. Excess hormone production, if present, can be documented using certain blood or urine tests. Although imaging can provide very good information, it can't make an absolute distinction between a cancerous and non-cancerous mass. Biopsy, which is often a go-to diagnostic test for other types of tumors, is ineffective at making this distinction with most adrenal masses and can be harmful. However, a biopsy may be helpful in people with known cancer that may have spread to the adrenal gland. In masses that are larger, have cancer-like characteristics, or are having a harmful impact on hormone levels, surgical removal of the mass is likely to be discussed or recommended. Fortunately, the majority of smaller masses are non-cancerous and can be followed with repeat imaging. News and our views. Highly processed foods may shorten the lifespan. When it comes to a healthy diet, convenience may have a cost. A new study measures the possibly detrimental relationship between consuming highly processed foods and longevity. The study, published in the April 1, 2019 issue of JAMA Internal Medicine, looked at the data of 44,000 participants who provided at least 72 hours of self-reported dietary habits. From these, researchers measured the proportion of ultra-processed foods consumed. These foods, such as snack cakes, chicken nuggets, cheese puffs, and sugary beverages, are manufactured through a number of industrial processes and typically have added colors, sugars, salts, and preservatives that offer no nutritional value. The researchers found that every 10% increase in consumption of ultra-processed foods was associated with an increase in deaths from all cancers with an average of about 7 years of follow-up. This increase was still significant when adjusted for factors such as body mass index, physical activity level, and family history of cancer or cardiovascular disease. A major limitation to the study was that it relied on self-reported data, which often isn't as accurate, an accurate indicator of food intake, weight, and other factors. It also can't be distinguished whether the increased death rate was caused by processed food intake, or if it was because of reduced intake of fresh whole foods, or some other unmeasured variable. Still, Mayo Clinic experts emphasize that fresh, whole foods and minimally processed foods are ideal choices for a healthy diet. They're abundant in essential nutrients such as vitamins, minerals, and fiber, and they contain little to no additives. Gallstones, a plan of attack. You try to stick to a healthy diet. Still, lately it seems that a couple of hours after eating any fatty food, you're met with abdominal discomfort. Gallstones are common, affecting up to 25% of people. While only one-third of people with gallstones will ever experience pain from a gallstone blockage, those who do often struggle with maintaining their quality of life and may be at risk of dangerous complications. How gallstones develop. Your gallbladder rests in the upper right side of your abdomen, just beneath your liver. The gallbladder stores a fluid that breaks down fats and acids and aids in digestion, which is bile. If the composition of bile, including cholesterol and a substance made during the normal breakdown of red blood cells, which is bilirubin, becomes imbalanced, hardened deposits of these materials may form. These are gallstones. The stones may be solitary or develop in groups, and they can range in size from a grain of sand to a golf ball. Your risk of gallstones increases if you're over age 40, particularly if you're female. Other risk factors include Native American or Mexican American heritage or family history of gallstones. Certain health conditions such as cirrhosis of the liver, diabetes, or Crohn's disease increase your risk. So does having high triglycerides or low levels of high-density lipoprotein, HDL, or the good cholesterol. Weight in particular affects your risk of gallstones. You're more likely to develop gallstones if you're obese, especially if you're female. People who experience fast weight loss, such as from weight loss surgery or very low-calorie diets, also more likely to develop gallstones. Diets high in calories and refined carbohydrates and low in fiber also have been linked to the condition. Behind an attack. The majority of the time, gallstones produce no symptoms, but if a gallstone lodges in a bile duct and causes a blockage, you may experience the signs and symptoms of biliary colic, a so-called gallbladder attack. And these include sudden pain in the upper right abdomen, sudden pain in the center of your abdomen just below your breastbone, pain between your shoulder blades, pain in your right shoulder, nausea or vomiting. Gallbladder attacks may last 30 minutes to several hours, although pain generally peaks after about an hour and then subsides. Attacks often occur after heavy, fatty meals and usually occur in the evening or overnight. Once the stone dislodges, the pain ends. Pain from an attack can typically be managed with pain-relieving drugs such as ibuprofen, which is Advil, Motrin IV, and others. Still, it's wise to see your doctor, especially if you experience recurrent or worsening symptoms. Your doctor will typically review your symptoms, personal and family health history, and dietary habits. A physical exam will follow, including a check for tenderness in your abdomen. A blood test also may be done to check for signs of infection or inflammation. An abdominal ultrasound is most commonly used to detect the presence of gallstones, although other types of imaging may be recommended if results are inconclusive or if complications are suspected. Surgery, definitive treatment. The typical treatment for symptomatic gallstones is surgery to remove the gallbladder. It's one of the most common surgical procedures performed in adults in the U.S. Surgery is also occasionally recommended for larger gallstones, even if they aren't causing symptoms. Surgery is the only method to fully resolve gallbladder attacks and prevent gallstone complications. The surgery, which is called a cholecystectomy, is done under general anesthesia. Open surgery is an option, especially if the gallbladder is severely inflamed or infected. However, most surgeries are done with a minimally invasive approach, either laparoscopically or robotically. The minimally invasive techniques use 1 to 4 small incisions and a camera to visualize the inside of the abdomen and remove the gallbladder. It's often done as an outpatient procedure, meaning you may be able to return home the same day into normal levels of physical activity in about a week. You should be able to live a normal life without a gallbladder, which isn't an essential organ. Bile flows out of your liver directly into the small intestine, Some people report having softer and more frequent stools or urgency to have a bowel movement after the procedure, but these are usually temporary. Rarely, your doctor may recommend removing or destroying gallstones rather than removing the gallbladder. This may mean using drugs that dissolve smaller cholesterol-based stones. When this treatment is successful, symptoms typically subside in a few weeks. However, it can take months to years of treatment to dissolve gallstones, and they often form again if treatment is stopped. Research continues to look at new ways to manage gallstones, including medications that reduce cholesterol secretion or increase the dissolvability of cholesterol. Recognizing an emergency, blockages that last for more than a few hours can cause complications such as an infection or inflammation of nearby organs. Watch for these warning signs: abdominal pain that lasts for several hours, nausea and vomiting, fever or chills, yellow skin or eyes, which is jaundice, tea-colored urine or light-hued stool. If these signs and symptoms occur, see a doctor immediately. Left untreated, gallstone complications can be fatal. Preventing gallstones. Major risk factors for gallstones are tied to lifestyle choices. Taking preventive steps may help keep them at bay, including reducing unhealthy fats, replace saturated and trans fats with healthier monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats, increasing fiber intake, limit refined carbohydrates and boost your diet with fiber-filled options. Being physically active, aim for at least 150 minutes a week of aerobic activity. Losing weight slowly. Slow and steady weight loss and maintenance afterward are key. Easing chemo-related nasal symptoms naturally. Recent Mayo Clinic research indicates that dryness, tenderness, scabbing, and bleeding of the nasal passages, known as nasal vestibulitis, is a much more common side effect of chemotherapy than previously thought. A nasal spray containing rose geranium in sesame oil has a track record of being an untested but still used way to reduce symptoms of nasal vestibulitis. That's why our researchers at Mayo Clinic decided to put the nasal spray to the test. Nearly all women use the spray daily for multiple times a day, and among them, 11 experienced a moderate benefit, 6 a dramatic benefit, and 2 a complete resolution of symptoms. Ask your healthcare team for help locating a pharmacy that can compound the formula for you. So we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And a reminder that you have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, which was previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Stay healthy.